In conversation with Dr. Eve.
12 minutes past 8. Good evening, Dr. Eve. Lovely chatting to you again.
Hi, Gershaw. Nice to be with you. Always nice to be with you. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation and inviting our listeners in to think a little out of the box.
Indeed, indeed.
I hope you're curious as well.
Very much so. That's why I jumped straight into it, because it's... from the little that I've seen, the little I've read over, it's something that I'm unfamiliar with, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it and learning more about it. As you said from the onset, we know that at times, not always, but at times our listeners can be a little shy, discussing these matters. 011-883-0702, alternatively 021-446-0567. Give us a call, please. And ask your questions, share your experiences, and let's have a great conversation. And hear from you what are some of your questions. But Dr. Eve, I'm going to kick off immediately by asking, we're obviously talking about the trauma of sexual, gender, and sexual orientation disfiguration. But from what I can see, it's basically the starting point is using the theory of sexual configuration. What is that?
Yeah, so last week, I think it's 2 weeks ago. It's 2 weeks ago now, actually, Gershaw, as the listeners who were listening in 2 weeks ago might remember. I was part of the World Association of Sexual Health, which is a global organization for sexual health, sexual rights, and sexual pleasure. And I was the local scientific chair and very involved in planning this for 2 years. And so we had wonderful presentations, and a number of them obviously struck out as being very congruent with the theme. And our theme was sexual justice. Wow. And that was because if we consider what's been going on most recently, last 18 months since COVID, really, there's been a huge focus on social justice and racial justice, on justice for almost anything, everyone. People are like really intent on having, justice in their lives, feeling no longer being able to carry the burden of injustice on so many different levels and structures of society. And so the notion of sexual justice is something that I feel very strongly about. And I'm bringing in this theory, which is called the sexual configurations theory, as part of that discussion within the broad context of sexual justice for all of us, for all our listeners, for people who are feeling that they're not truly able to express their sexual orientation, their gender identities, their eroticism within the kinds of relationships and with the people that they really want because of so many societal restrictions, norms, norms such as compulsive monogamy, as we call it, which is that we have to be only committed, intimate, in love, sexual with one person your whole life and commit to that for your whole life. And when people deviate, and they absolutely do, from that compulsive monogamy model, heterosexist, heteronormative model, they feel guilt and shame. And they may not go to the end point of trauma, but they certainly will be in the continuum of feeling challenged, stressed, distressed, because they're not able to really live according to their own configuration of how they configure their own orientation, gender, who they love, how many people they love, what kind of sexual activity they want to engage in. So this is a theory which was designed by Dr. Sari van Anders, who's a research chair in social neuroendocrinology, sexuality and gender, and sex in Canada. And her theory has really taken off, and we're wanting to actualize it, which is what we're doing tonight, is to get people to call us and to share with us if they really feel that their configuration of that heteromono, meaning monogamous, heterosexual, normative model, doesn't fit in for them. If they feel that they are challenged or stressed because they're not able to have, for example, a polyamorous life, which means actually I want to have a sexual relationship with more than one person, but I want to have what she calls a nurturance relationship with only one. So I only want to really just love one person, have a family with that person, travel with that person, go to restaurants with that person, but I really would like to be sexual with more than one person in a consensual way, in a way that isn't cheating, in a way that my partner and I can talk about and agree to. So that's, you know, the one part. The other one is the sexual orientation of, well, actually, I think that I may be bisexual. I'm attracted to and very much able to be in love with a man, with a woman, with a trans person. I'm open to that. I feel that my orientation is one which is not fixed, but, you know, pretty fluid. And yet I'm stuck in a society that would really harm me, that would villainize me, that may hurt me because of cultural, religious, class injustices that exist and constrict me. And therefore, I feel my mental health has been impaired and threatened by this. And then we come to gender dysphoria, where that happens to people who are trans and gender binaried, and they really struggle with feeling that I'm not congruent with the sex into which I was born, and I really would like to live a more trans and gender diverse identity and lifestyle. So we have all these different elements in which people feel great unsettlement. And, you know, why is it important? I repeat, because it impacts on one's mental health, on the mental health of people, and therefore on productivity, ability to feel engaged, socialize, feel comfortable in their own bodies, feel comfortable in their own sexuality. So I hope that I'm giving you a kind of basic framework for people to understand what we're looking for tonight, to invite them to talk to us about their dis-ease, challenge, distress, and feelings of trauma, because they're not able to live a configurated sexuality and relationship and loving life as much as they would like to.
Absolutely stunning. And I saw that the phone lines are ringing, so hopefully people can come through on 011-883-0702, alternatively 021-446-0567. Let's have these conversations. Dr. Eve, I was listening with great intrigue, and you know, so many questions already started going off in my mind. And I think first and foremost is, you know, when we talk about being, you know, living in a heteronormative society, it means that the norm is the hetero, you know, is portrayed as the heterosexual relationship, usually marriage, monogamous, 2.5 children, white picket fence, right? And that everything else outside of that image automatically seems, and not only automatically seems, but society basically tells us that it's deviant, that there's something wrong with it, right? And I guess part of the biggest issue is then, you know, we don't want to be judged by society. I think it's an innate human thing. And because we don't want to be judged, it becomes so difficult for you then to truly express, whether it's a conversation, whether it is sharing with your partner or telling people. It's difficult then to say to them that, listen, this is where I am at, and I don't squarely fit into your heteronormative box.
Yeah, big challenge for partners to have to even to, Gershwin, even just to raise that discussion of saying, I don't feel comfortable. And even though we live in a society, and certainly in South Africa, because of our constitution, that there will be no discrimination against anyone. I mean, come on, you know, let's be real, that it's there in policy and in law, but in actual real lived life, people continue to be discriminated and judged, even people who are seen to be kink, living a BDSM life. They really have to be in a closet. People who are polyamorous or swinging, have more than one partner. They are absolutely standardized because of the societal fear that keeps them locked up in what society deems to be normal. And maybe that deems what is normal is really what the majority is. But is it really the majority? I mean, we kind of seen incredibly interesting statistics come out of Generation Z, where so many of them identify today as being non-binary.
Exactly.
Non-binary and gender diverse. So what is normal anymore? And most importantly, what we want from our listeners is, you know, how is it affecting your life? What is your own intimate personal life configured? How is that configured for you? And are you happy with the configuration that you have with the partner or partners?
No, indeed. I mean, you know, I have to, because of the work that I do, you know, sometimes moderate, say, a webinar or speak publicly, basically. And, you know, it was, I guess, 5 years ago, if you open an event and you said, you know, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, very few people would have raised an eyebrow. And now I'm cognizant of the fact that, you know, that you have people who are non-binary in the room. And so I prefer to say good evening or good afternoon or good morning, everyone, as you know, and be more inclusive. And that is because I think Generation Z, as you pointed out, have taught us that, listen, you can't just exclude me. As nice and as wonderful as it sounds, you know, these platitudes that you give out when you start off these events, well, you're actually excluding people, actually. And you know, that's not a nice thing. So I think that's an important thing. But what I'm getting at is, in as much as I guess Generation Z and a lot of thought has gone into this, and I guess for rational, progressive society, we think and understand these issues. I think that we do not openly speak about this. I think I've mentioned this to you before, Dr. Eve, that as South Africans, we tend to be very shtum about sex, sexuality. you know, when the lights go out, we go crazy, proverbially speaking. But, you know, out in public, we people of the church, and we don't even think about these things. So, I guess what then happens is, I don't know, I might feel a little kinky, but I'm too scared to bring it up with my wife because goodness knows, what if she judges me? What if she freaks out? What if my colleagues find out that I have, I don't know, a BDSM suit at home, my private little play dungeon at home? People will think that I'm weird, and I'm, you know, and those are the things that we immediately think of.
Yeah, much to the disadvantage of our children. We've got enough research on that. When we keep shtum about sexuality in the home, we know the impact of that on children, where they, in their ignorance, will seek out information. And where do they seek information, Gershwin? I mean, through pornography. That becomes the educator of girls and boys from age 9 up. And we know that in the schools, this is really not happening. And there's a strong push, and this was a huge part of the Congress, was comprehensive sexuality education, and how do we go about doing diverse comprehensive sexuality education so we can put young people less at risk and protect them more. So this is, you know, such a huge, important conversation to be having. I think, you know, I'm so keen, I think in 2 weeks' time or so, we may talk about, you know, bad sex, because this is something which has been on my mind a lot, the bad sex of people. But let's not divert. I mean, it's part of your sexual configuration as well. You know, would you speak up? If you were having, you know, bad sex or sex that didn't arouse you, and you were indeed a BDSM practitioner, and you were not able to tell that to your partner, and how, you know, you're not getting aroused, and your partner sees, well, this guy isn't getting erect, so he's not into me, he doesn't find me sexy, and then either she's going to go and have an affair, or he's going to go somewhere else to practice BDSM, and there's secrecy, and then there's the incredible trauma of infidelity that happens. Do you see how this goes down the rabbit hole, and why this is so important that we're able to figure out and be able to talk about what our own orientation, sexual lusting, our love, our gender really is all about?
I find it fascinating, but also, you know, how, I guess, in any relationship, two people grow. And you know, what if interests are, and I don't want to use the wrong terminology, but let's stick with BDSM as an example, right? I start developing an interest in, say, BDSM, and you know, we move on with time, and look, my partner and I have just not tried this at all. We've never gone down that rabbit hole. We've never tried it, but now it's gotten to the stage whereby, you know, you're too worried to be able to say to your partner that, hang on, I'm actually really interested in it. Or let's take it to another level. When we talk about sexual orientation, all too often people get married to each other as a heterosexual couple. And lo and behold, maybe in their past, and sometimes because, again, societal pressures, one of the partners may be bi. And being bisexual, you know, you try to leave it in the past. I'm married now. I'm grown up. this is no longer part of my life. And then, you know, you are bisexual. So whether it takes a year, whether it takes 5 years, whether it takes 10 years or 50 years, down the line, how do you then go back to your partner and say that, listen, I'm not, you know, cisgender, heterosexual, Gershwal, I'm actually bi. And how do we broach that without judgment and anger and fear and worry and fighting? And I think that's what really scares a lot of people.
Yeah, indeed. It's a very risky situation and one has to time it. And as a clinician, it's about, there's a process that we hopefully encourage people or and educate people into, which is coming out to oneself first, because that's the hardest part, really, Gershwal, is taking ownership. I am not fitting into this model. And I'm going to keep coming back to mental health, because people who do not stay true or unable to really stay true to their own sexual configurations end up with all kinds of physical illnesses, which we've spoken about on this show, you know, the trauma of what trauma impacts, how trauma impacts on physical illnesses, inflammations, actual physical illnesses of the body, and then mental illnesses such as anxiety, depression, eating disorders, acting out, obsessive compulsive behaviors, alcohol, drugs, risky sexual experiences, adventure, workaholism, you know, so many different behaviors that we see. And when we keep unpeeling the onion, it really comes down to our social, intimate, relational connections in which we're not able to really be truly self, be integrated and embodied in self with all the bits and pieces that we know make us feel connected to other humans and to ourselves. And that comes down to intimacy and connection through sexuality or through love.
Indeed, and I guess it's a very, I'm sure there's very many examples. I think you and I have thrown out quite a couple of examples there with, and I'm sure that there are people sitting at home right now listening to this conversation and saying, well, that's what I'm experiencing in my relationship. That's what I've experienced in a relationship that unfortunately ended, in a past relationship. These are some of the issues, or maybe part of the reason why I'm having difficulty relating with other people is because of these, this notion of this is cisgender heteronormative behavior, and this is what is expected, and I don't quite fit that mold. So therefore, I'm concerned and worried that there is going to be judgment, if not already encountering such judgment. And I think it would be important and key for us to have that conversation and hear from people what their experiences are. So again, 011-883-0702, alternatively 021-446-0567. Dr. Eve, we're just going to take a quick break, I guess, give people an opportunity to, swallow, sit down, take a deep breath, and give us a call.
In conversation with Dr. Eve.
28 minutes to go before we get to 9 o'clock. Gershwal Brooks in for Aubrey Masango, and a very interesting conversation that we're having with Dr. Eve as we speak. 011-883-0702, alternatively 021-446-0567. SMS is, of course, on 31702 and 31567. And for those of you that want to WhatsApp us, please pop us a WhatsApp on 072-702-1702. For those of you on social media, that's Twitter as well as Facebook, hashtag Aubrey Masango Show. That's what you look for. Hashtag Aubrey Masango Show. You can get a hold of us there. Tweet me, Facebook me, and you can raise your questions there even. And for those of you that might feel a bit awkward, discussing this, on air in front of everyone, by all means, if you feel more comfortable giving us an anonymous call, please, by all means, go ahead. Let's hear from you and hear about your own experiences. I mean, ultimately, Dr. Eve, it's again developing the tools for how we relate to each other and how one can then be honest. Because I guess a lot of dishonesty doesn't necessarily, not dishonesty, but withholding the truth, I guess, doesn't come from a place of malice. You know, I'm lying to you because I don't know, I want to trick you on or mislead you. It is because maybe it's our own internal fear, own internal, concern and worry for being judged, you know, for being seen as an outsider in so many instances.
Yeah, I agree with you. And what I want to do, Gershwell, is to throw out a question to our listeners and to invite, as you're listening to us now, to consider for yourself, what is it that you most require right now at this age, at this stage, in this lifespan that you're in now from your current partner or partners? Is it that you seek eroticism or nutrients? And just to give you some definitions of those again, eroticism, where you feel sexually tantalized, aroused, where there's genital pleasure and fantasies and phone sex and sexting and sexual chemistry. So do you seek that from your current partner or partners, or is it that you seek out eroticism, which not erotic, nurturance, which is warm and loving feelings and closeness and support and affection and emotional connection and hugs, but not the erotic side of things? And do you want, desire one or the other from other people, one other person, or many other partners? Because in the configuration theory of Sari van Anders, she really configures it that there are so many choices that we have to be able to divide our lives up into the kind of sexual, intimate, loving spaces that we want, with one person for this, another person for that. When I'm traveling, then I want to just be able to have an erotic connection with somebody, but without any kind of nurturance from that person. When I'm with my partner, I really just want to have an agreement on nurturance of care and hugs, and have an agreement that I can be sexual with different identity, different gender, different orientation, different place. So it really is up to each of us to, as adults, consensual adults, because we're not children, as consensual adults, to be able to take responsibility for our own sexuality, take our own agency and authority, rather than being dictated to by the fears of society.
I hear you. And you know, the immediate thing that comes up, and hopefully someone calls in with either an experience of this, even if it's their question, Dr. Eve, is how does one navigate that? Because, you know, that's what I always find intriguing. Because as you know, as human beings, it's, I mean, going back to some of what we discussed and the examples that we discussed earlier on, all too often, let's say we look at sexual orientation again and say someone is bisexual. I might not even have the label or the knowledge that this is, you know, this is my sexual orientation, or this is how I necessarily feel. It may be confusing. It may be something that you suppress. It may be something that you say, no, you know, I'll pray it away, or whatever the case is. But you may, in fact, actually be bi. As you go along, now you have to navigate it. So, yes, you know how you feel. You know what you want. The issue is, how do you go about, what tools do you then use in an effort to then go about being able to communicate that to your partner in such a way that, A, it doesn't just lead, I guess there may be some conflict, but I don't want to lose my partner, but at the very same time, this is actually where I am at, and I need to find a way to convey it to this person.
You know, Gershwell, partners can feel over a period of time that the other person is not truly or present with them, whether in a sexual or an emotional space. They get a sense that, and they don't understand it, and they may say, hey, you know, I feel that you're distant, or I don't really understand what's going on, or I notice you don't enjoy being sexual, or you're not interested in being sexual. They notice, and obviously we all choose to push aside that gut reaction because we don't want to have to deal with the truth or what we suspect. So the person who is configuring that they're not in this monoheteronormative model, they are finding out for themselves around their own truth. And they do this by, for example, a man might then get onto Grindr and just start looking around there, go onto porn and start watching trans women and feeling, you know, really aroused, and follow that path and organically move into more and more curiosity, even meeting up. A guy might meet up with a guy and just to chat and to have a friendship, or just to be able to feel what it feels like to be in the company of men. Maybe go in the old days when people could go to bars or clubs and hang out there and get a sense. So they're organically moving into those spaces, further away from the partner. And once as I said, that solidified for them that, yeah, I really, really take ownership of the fact that I am a trans or gender diverse person. Only then, when they feel more confident, will they reveal, or else they get caught out with so-called cheating, being online. The partner will find out that, oh, this person's really, for example, they might find out that their partner is sexting hugely with other, say it's a heterosexual couple, and she will find out that he spends a lot of time on his phone and discovers that he's sexting sex workers. And she would, you know, be enormously distressed about this, because it could be for her a sign of cheating. And when confronted, he would say, but this is something that I want to have as part of my configuration of my sexuality, because it makes me feel desired in a certain way. It makes me feel alive. With you, I feel safe and nurtured and supported, and we enjoy a sexual life of sorts. But this is a part, and how can we agree to have this part of our sexual life, my sexual life, without it threatening your security, your sense of safety? Or chase, we want to feel safe and secure.
Yeah.
So how can we configure a situation where we don't just throw it all out and give it all away, but actually can bring this part of me into our relationship as well, or I can keep it there, but still make you feel safe and secure?
100%. Let's go to Richard in Four Ways. Richard, good evening, and thank you for calling us this evening.
Hi, good evening, Gershon and Dr. Eve. I think I just wanted to contribute something here to, let's call it the reality. The first thing is, I think we all believe in majority rule, which I suppose you can call groupthink. And, you know, when we have all these different shades and flavors, we tend to be biting the whole of society for a smaller portion of society. And generally, that doesn't have any sway in our political voting scenario. So it's quite a strange thing that it's taken such prominence. And that's just the first point I want to make. Second point is that I was married the first time for 10 odd years, or in a relationship, and my first wife. Very close with her family. My family wasn't close. That was attractive to me. And it was too close. That didn't work. Met my second wife. Incredibly amazing person. Absolutely amazing person. Together 11 years. And then she left for a woman. And it was all of a sudden, within a week, she was gone. And arguably, you know, certainly at that stage of my life, I thought she was the love of my life, and she was an absolute incredible nurture mom to my kids, and a fantastic partner, and it just went on. And then I found out that she had actually had previous lesbian relationships. She had been married to a bloke before for 2 years in her mid-20s, and she's now married to this lady, and it seems that there was a trauma in my second wife's life when she was about 13, and her father went to jail for 3 years, and her mother had abandoned her, arguably at a couple of months old or something like that. So she had this trauma, but she didn't disclose it. This is my point. And if she hadn't disclosed it, I would not have continued the relationship with her after I'd met her. And I think it's fundamental that there's that disclosure, because otherwise it becomes a dishonesty, because I'm sure at that point in time she would have realized and would have known that I would not have carried on the relationship. It's too risky for a normal heterosexual male. It's just too risky. So, you know, I just wanted to contribute that and say, you know, that's coming from somebody who's been exposed to this, and it is incredibly hurtful. It's taken me about 7 years to recover from this emotionally.
Sure. Thanks, Richard, for your call. Thanks, Richard from Four Ways there. Dr. Eve?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. And I would have, you know, liked to know if there were any red flags that your body kind of lit up and let you know.
Richard is still with us. Richard, can you hear Dr. Richard? Eve?
Yes, I am. I can hear her very faintly, though.
I'm fine. Well, Gershaw will talk to you.
Yeah.
You can't hear me. I'm curious to know if there were any red flags, if there was any knowing.
I can't hear you.
Sure, Richard, I'll convey it. What Dr. Eve is asking is, during your relationship, were there any red flags that you noticed?
No, nothing. It was such a surprise.
surprised that she was interested in women.
Absolute
surprise. Yeah, no, it was. And she's a very feminine girl. I suppose she probably is. I haven't been in contact with her for quite a few years. her choice, that is. But very feminine. Yeah, I mean, extreme of femininity, in fact.
Okay.
So I want to just talk to a few points that, Richard, that you raised. The first one being around, you know, majority rule, and this is such a small minority group. Why we, you know, why do we put such a big focus and give so much attention and even throw money at it? And this is an argument, Gershwin, that is, you know, thrown up, which makes me want to throw up, actually, because we're talking about social justice and sexual justice, and everybody has a right to be present and to be happy and to have good mental health. So it doesn't matter. The majority might be what they think they are. They think they're monoheteronormative. If you look at the statistics, we're not so sure about that being the majority, actually. Then the other thing is, I just want to also just correct two other misconceptions or myths that Richard has raised in terms of trauma in your life doesn't lead to have any impact on sexual orientation or who you're attracted to or to your gender identity at all. That's, you know, just another myth we just really want to do away with. Trauma in your life, especially one, as you describe, of abandonment, neglect, or emotional abuse, will lead to different forms of configurations of attachment and commitment, but not to anything to your sexual orientation. And then also, Richard, you know, with great kindness to you, because you're giving me an opportunity for educating everyone, and I really thank you for this, is that if somebody is feminine, it doesn't mean they're heterosexual.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't matter how you look, you know, we're back to the miniskirt kind of thing, Gershwin, that it doesn't matter how you look. We don't put people into labels or boxes according to their appearance.
Or their behavior or their manifestation or, you know.
Yeah, how they present. I think about, the magnificent, for me, the incredible privilege, I think, Gershwin, the privilege of when I used to go into real life conferences up to 2 years ago, and now even online congresses, and as I spent 4 days on a congress, a global congress, and to see the diversity of presentation, whether it is body modifications or it is tattoos that people are doing, it's just magnificent to see the freedom that people, especially younger generations, allow themselves, which says nothing about them as people. It's just a magnificent opening up. And what we're doing now tonight even is educating people into a place of sexual justice where there should not be any judgment made or assumptions made on the way that you look, whether you're feminine or butch looking. It really, really doesn't count for anything. It's a wonderful expression of how we present ourselves, and we should all be taking that liberty.
And that's the amazing thing, is that, as you said, you know, looking at, for lack of a better term, you know, the younger generation, Generation Z, I mean, someone could be cisgender, heterosexual, male, and he doesn't have an issue, with how he presents himself, if it's deemed as being slightly, if it's deemed as being effeminate in any shape or form. I think, again, you know, a very quintessential, at least from my experience, and I hate to sound judgy, but it's my experience, it's my observation. We very much taken up by that. We, especially in South Africa, you know, and in some societies, which tend to be a little more conservative, that we very much focused on that. You know, you have to be very, you know, the uber masculine male. You have to be extremely effeminate as a woman. Because the moment that you come across in any other way, then there must be something afoot and something amiss. And I'm happy that you also clarified the issue about whether it be abuse or it be some trauma that someone had experienced early on. Because it's a narrative that I constantly hear, is that because A, B, C, D happened, and especially women, you know, all too often, she couldn't stay in the relationship because of this trauma. He became an abuser because of the trauma in his life. And I think it's a serious misnomer, because exactly what Richard said there, he said, listen, I wouldn't have been interested in this relationship had I known.
And I wonder if he was referring to had I known about her trauma or had I known about her proclivity to enjoy sex or love or fiction with women. Probably the latter, huh? Probably knew about the trauma and didn't know. He wouldn't have got into a relationship, which again, Gershwin, I mean, I respect the fact that it's ideal to be able to say, okay, so up front, I'm telling you, you know, I've had relationships with women. And even women do disclose that. There's this toxic masculinity that we know exists, which oh, I'm going to take that out of you. You know, I'm going to really get that out of you. And women have that as well. Like, I'm going to take this toxic masculinity. I know that you were abusive in your past relationship, but, you know, I'm going to be the golden vagina that fixes you. So we choose to discount that. And so interesting that as part of in this Congress, part of what is really highly recommended from UNESCO, no less, in terms of comprehensive sexuality education and what we should be including in curricula, is toxic masculinity, that we really need to be addressing that and unburdening men from exactly what you were saying, this characterization of this strong man, you know, this Popeye with the big arms and the small waist and the big chest to be strong and to be physically strong so that he can feel more masculine and to be able to personify and represent himself in such a way to boost up that sense of being masculine in a world which is dangerous for men to be masculine, because, you know, men are killed by men hugely, much more than men kill women, actually. You know, we don't talk about that enough. So that's very much something that needs to be spoken about in terms of men want as well. That, you know, if you spoke about BDSM, if you are a man who wants to be dominated, I mean, that's a real con that men who carry all the authority and the power which society burdens them with would go to a mistress or a master for discipline from a BDSM practice, because they just want to relinquish that toxicity around what to be a man.
It's absolutely fascinating. And Dr. Eve, no matter how many times you and I chat, it always feels that the same themes come through, and one of those themes that you highlighted now is exactly those perceptions that still persist. You know, a lot of it toxic masculinity, but a lot of it also what heteronormative society tells us is this is what it is, you know. But I got a quick WhatsApp that came in. Yeah, I just want to quickly share it with you. It says, "Hi Gersh, great show. My girlfriend and I have been together for just over 5 years. I live in Johannesburg where she lives in the Eastern Cape. We see each other about 4 times a year. What worries me is that whenever we are together, she hardly ever shows sexual interest, whereas I want to make the most of our time together. I have never cheated, and I know that she hasn't as well. And that is what makes me even more eager to have sex whenever I'm with her. But I'm afraid that this might impact our relationship together, as I'm planning on marrying her, but because she doesn't have a sexual appetite like mine, it might affect our marriage. Is there any way that I can improve her sexual appetite or improve our sex life? Please ask Dr. Eve in advice. I tried speaking to her to invite a third party perhaps, but she shows no interest in even that, and she recommended we rather use toys, but I don't feel comfortable in using toys." And this is the WhatsApp that I received.
I love that there's an awareness. I love that there's a noticing. If there is so much sexual discrepancy, you want to pause and you want to consider, how is this going to impact? Not how are we going to get each other to be in the same sexual space, but how is this going to impact our relationship, our trust, our sense of comfort, and always come back to security with each other. So if you are together, you've together 5 years in a long distance relationship, you see each other 4 times a year, and in that time she has a low or no interest in being sexual. And what I'm hearing, which kind of jerks me a little, Gershwin, is that almost can hear some shame and guilt from him around wanting to be sexual and being rejected, and you know even going to the extent of saying, proudly, "We don't cheat," and what I hear, you know, is he's scared to lose it, which is, you know, why we stay silent, why we stay stumm, is because we're scared to lose the person, yeah. So we don't say anything. I do want to say to him that in terms of sexual justice, your right to sexual pleasure and sexual health is being denied 4 times a year, and you're not being sexual with each other. That would be a red flag for me, that really there isn't a sexual interest from your partner. And she's letting you know that you even go to the extent, and this is what is just so beautiful today, that people think out the box and say, well, okay, let's bring in a third party, you know, let's kind of get a little poly here. And she says, no, let's bring in some toys. So when you inquire, it's always so interesting what people do want. You know, why does she want toys? Is he a bad lover? Is he not, you know, attending to her clitoral needs that she wants to bring some toys in? Is he ejaculating too fast? You know, she's saying bring in some toys. What she does it mean she's playing with toys on her own and she's got used to that. So here are, you know, wonderful, wonderful clues that I would encourage him to explore, because he's holding back on full commitment, knowing that there is a sense of dis-ease that he carries. So keep talking to it without judgment, and take away the shame that you feel around wanting sex with her. This is something that happens with people when they're attracted to each other and they feel aroused with each other. That's a natural inclination of wanting to be sexual. It's an expression of wanting that connection and closeness in a very intimate way. So please don't ever feel ashamed of your sexual part.
And what I find fascinating as well is that this conversation is happening at this stage. And I think it's also a rarity in I would say older generations, where these conversations were had already. What is our, I don't know, sexual compatibility, for lack of a better term, you know? When are you on and when are you off? And do we understand that about each other? Because I think it is essential. And part of the question that's being asked in the WhatsApp is this going to have a long-term impact on our relationship going forward? Dr. Eve, look, we basically out of time. I mean, any final thoughts that you want to leave us with in the minute that we have left?
I'm hoping that this conversation, like all our conversations here, provoke people just to invite their partners into having a conversation, into being really, you know, honest about your own configuration, what it is you long for, what it is that you would like, and to find an opportunity. If it's safe, and I do stress it's safe because we have such a high number of gender-based violence incidents and intimate partner and femicide in our country, so people have to be careful of whether it's safe to share this with somebody else. So that's always the first concern that I have. And to be able to see, can I take the risk of losing or losing this partner as compared to the evil of living in disquiet and challenge, distress, and maybe even feeling traumatized and acting out. So I hope this will be a provocative or encouraging and motivational, supportive conversation for you to say, hey, you know what, I listened to Dr. Eve and Gershwell speaking, and I want to have this conversation with you. I would really like that. So, yeah, you can read the blog on my website, dreve.co.za, awesome. And follow me on Instagram, because we have lots of these conversations on Instagram. And or on Twitter and Facebook. So come and join me, and let's keep talking and educating and informing each other. And thank you so much, Gershwell, for a beautiful conversation.